Welcome to the StoryGrid Editor Roundtable Podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better editor, following the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne, an editor with over 25 years' experience. My name is Kim Kessler, and I'm the moderator for today's roundtable. Joining me shortly are four of my fellow certified StoryGrid editors, Jari Bolander, Valerie Francis, Anne Holly, and Leslie Watts. Each week, we watch a movie from one of the 12 content genres and complete a global Fool's Cup worksheet, then discuss it using the six core questions. This week, we're analyzing the 1992 movie, A Midnight Clear, written and directed by Keith Gordon, based on the 1982 novel by William Wharton. Here's a synopsis adapted from Wikipedia. The story takes place December 1944, toward the end of World War II, in the early phase of the Battle of the Bulge. And it centers on a small U.S. Army intelligence and reconnaissance squad, selected for their high IQs. Losses from an earlier patrol has reduced the squad from 12 to just 6 men. One is nicknamed Mother, played by Gary Sinise, because he is constantly on them for their sloppiness, and another is nicknamed Father because he dropped out of the seminary and has a no-swearing rule. The protagonist and leader is Sergeant Knott, played by Ethan Hawke, who is the youngest but begrudgingly has been put in charge of the squad. The squad is sent to occupy a desert chateau near the German lines to gather information on the enemy's movements. On their way to the chateau, they discover the frozen corpses of a German and American standing in embrace, seemingly arranged by the Germans as a grim joke. Settling in their temporary home, they soon discover they are not alone. A group of German soldiers has occupied a position nearby. While out on patrol, three of the American soldiers see a trio of German soldiers aiming their weapons at them, but the enemy then vanished without shooting. The Germans, clearly more skilled and experienced than the young GIs, soon leave calling cards, start a snowball fight one evening, and offer a Christmas truce. At first, the Americans think the Germans are taunting them, but it eventually becomes clear that the enemy want to parley. One of the American soldiers speaks enough German to communicate with the enemy, who turn out to be a small group of youngsters, still in their teens, commanded by an aging NCO. Having survived the Russian front, the Germans say they wish to surrender, but they ask that the Americans pretend that they were captured in combat so as to protect their families back home from the possible retribution for their desertion. The Americans agree, but they keep the plan from Mother, who has been mentally unstable since learning of the death of his child back home. The two groups meet and proceed to fire their weapons in the air as planned. However, Mother hears the shooting and thinks the engagement is real. Arriving at the scene, Mother opens fire on the Germans. The latter, thinking that they have been tricked, immediately shoot back. The situation immediately goes out of control, and the American squad are forced to kill all of the enemy soldiers, but not before one of their own, Father, is fatally hit and another is badly wounded. Father's final words are to beg the others not to tell Mother that the skirmish was intended to be a fake. The squad's superior officer arrives, reprimanding them for their conduct, before taking their wounded man back for treatment. They later receive word that he died in the hospital. Left alone again, the four remaining soldiers quietly reflect and try to celebrate Christmas, cleaning Father's body in a bathtub. Shortly after, the Germans attack the area in strength, and the squad is forced to flee. Carrying Father's corpse, they disguise themselves as medics and escape back to the American lines. There, the squad leader is informed that Mother has been recommended for the Bronze Star and transferred to the motor pool, while the rest of the squad will be sent to the front line to fight as regular infantry. Okay, so we're going to go over the global genre, and Valerie, if you would please tell us what you got for that.
So for the global genre, I think it's a war brotherhood story because we're looking at the core values of honor and disgrace. And as we usually find, the more interesting discussion, I think, is going to come around the internal genre. And I waffled a little bit on this. Ultimately, I think it's a worldview maturation, but it's squishy. I think there's an argument to be made for, a strong argument to be made for worldview disillusionment, although Will Knott, as the protagonist, doesn't have a belief in the war at the beginning of the film. He does believe in his values, in his honor, the fact that they can get out of this alive. And he is constantly throughout the film trying to help his brothers. In the end, he is definitely disillusioned when he's sent back to the front line. So there's definitely an argument to be made there. However, I think there's a bit of a stronger argument to be made for worldview maturation. not, as we've said, is the youngest of the group. When he goes into the war, he's completely green. He's even a virgin. But at the beginning of the film, even though he's a little disenchanted with it, or a lot disenchanted with it all, I still see the whole thing as being like a family with not as the youngest. There's a mother, there's a father. At the beginning of the film, he isn't prepared to be considered, somewhere in here in my notes, I've got it. We want to make it clear that we're not part of the army, of this army. That's why they have the no obscenity rule. He is sensitive to profanity. He says that in there somewhere. It's amazing how much there is when you start to listen to it. Just thinking about mother's mental state scares him. He doesn't want to approach the frozen bodies. Miller actually does that. And he doesn't give commands or make decisions, even though he is the commanding officer. Now, if you look toward the end of the film, this all changes. He's starting to take on more and more responsibility as the film goes. He is concerned about protecting mother, about respecting father's wishes. He is the one who decides to help the Germans, and he overrides Miller's objections. And and he's the one who ultimately comes up with the plan to masquerade as medics. He does say to them all, you know, if anyone has any objections, speak now. So he does still take their thoughts into account, but he is definitely the one giving the orders. There's also, you can kind of look at the status pathetic in there. You can kind of look at status admiration, but I ruled those both out because he doesn't want to be the leader. He has no interest in rising within the structure. So I ruled those out. So I am willing to go with worldview disillusionment, but I'm leaning toward worldview maturation.
Okay. Well, yeah, and I love how you kind of looked at each one and then come to this conclusion, right? And I love the explanations, because I think when I first was even just reading the synopsis, it felt like disillusionment. But then you're right, it opens with him already somewhat disillusioned. He's not a true believer at any point. So that is a really good distinction. So does anybody else have any thoughts on the internal genre?
I would make an argument for the internal genre not being all that important in this story, because it's so, whether you talk about worldview, maturation, or disillusionment, or status, it's so bound up in the Brotherhood War story that it's just an interesting exercise to even try and make the distinction.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think I would agree on that. I mean, if you were to kind of look at all the pieces of someone's personality, like a hero, for example, like the hero's journey, they're all pieces and parts of the same person, and I don't really see them changing as much other than surviving. So,
so that's more of like a status?
Yeah, but even then, it's sort of like when he gets promoted, he's like, yeah, the only reason why I got promoted is because the other guy got trench foot and he was gone and they said, okay, you're it. I mean, it's just completely ridiculous. I mean, it's absurd. It's borderline like, this is just a shit show and we're just going to like walk around in the forest and, you know, and their major guy who's a nutcase is just going to be like, yeah, go figure it out and make sure you go find the enemy. And I mean, even when they leave, you know, spoiler alert, the major leaves them there and he's like, what the fuck over? Like, they're coming. They're going to kill us. Well, just stay as long enough to tell us that they're coming. You're like, you're going to hear them coming. They're going to bomb the shit out of us. And anyway, so yeah, I agree with Anne.
You'd be losing father's no profanity rule, by the way, Charlie.
Yeah, hey, you know what? sometimes words,
I think writers of everyone understand the need for profanity, because when it's the right word, it's the right word, and that's okay. Let's go on to the obligatory scenes of a war story. And Leslie, you're up.
So I viewed, because in the war story, the obligatory scenes are, you have to take the force of antagonism into account. And so in this case, I see the antagonist not as the enemy, but as the regimental commander, Major Griffin, and essentially the conditions within the army that allow such ridiculous policies by essentially a tyrant, such as, you know, filling intelligence squads with soldiers who score the highest on intelligence tests, regardless of their actual experience. And so that's the basis for my conclusions. So then I see the inciting attack as being what's described as the first map-inspired, ill-conceived recon patrol that ends with their losing half their squad. So intelligence squads are normally 12 people, and mm-hmm. they lose half of them as a mm-hmm. result of that inciting attack.
And that happens before it opens.
It's, yeah, he describes it, but yeah, it does happen off stage.
Okay.
Yeah. The protagonists deny responsibility to respond. This I'm a little fuzzy on, but there are several examples that could work here. It could be when Knott refuses to tell about Mother's episode. He doesn't wear his sergeant stripes after he's promoted. And then when they actually go to the chateau, he doesn't insist on maintaining military decorum and culture. They have this very lax atmosphere, and he allows them to light a fire, which is probably not a great idea.
Right.
So there's all kinds of examples of that. I'm not sure mm-hmm. precisely which one, but those are some to choose from. Then forced to respond, the protagonists lash out according to their positions in the power hierarchy. So Berg fails to go on duty. Schutzer, I think his name is. He mm-hmm. makes a snowman and writes the F-bomb Hitler with exclamation points made with twigs, I believe.
Right.
Knott throws grenades at a certain point. When he's angry, he's just pitching them. So there's different examples of different people kind of lashing out at different mm-hmm. times. Now, it's supposed to be an obligatory scene, so it should be nailed down to one. But,
right.
you know, as we noted before, the quality of the film made it difficult to take it all in.
Right. So, which we might not have mentioned on the recording. So the one that was available to us to watch was on YouTube, and it was very difficult. It was cropped down quite far, and characters were constantly walking out of frame. So it was harder to really take in the movie in the same way as if we were watching it on the big screen with all of the screen size.
Yeah, I found it distracting, especially in the beginning. I think further in, it wasn't
yes.
as, but
right.
anyway, okay, so then four, each protagonist learns what their antagonist's object of desire is, and to me, this is when Knott tells Lieutenant Ware about the strange events with the Germans, and they're ordered to go find a command post. Ware and Griffin, right? Mm-hmm. They just want information. They don't care if it's actually useful, if it's, you know, what's at risk in getting, mm-hmm. in obtaining the information. They just want intelligence at all cost, or any cost. So then fifth, the protagonist's initial strategy to outmaneuver the antagonist fails. Okay, so I have here, and this isn't, I'm looking at this and I'm recognizing that it's not right because I've shifted from uh-huh. essentially the leadership to the Germans. The Germans won't surrender to them but want to stage a fake battle, and that's not correct given the way I've set it up so far.
Okay, because the antagonist, we're saying, is the actual leadership within the American army.
And it may be that it's something similar, essentially, where I think Knott is trying to avoid telling them things.
Mm-hmm.
But when he does tell them, that's where I would look if I were to go deeper into this. I would look at the way that Knott is sharing or not sharing information with the leadership. So then six, the protagonists, realizing they must change their approach to attain a measure of victory, undergo an all-is-lost moment. So Mother isn't aware of the plan for the fake battle, and he opens fire on the German soldiers, and they return fire. They kill Mundy, father.
Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and they mortally wound Schutzer. So, yeah, that's like,
yeah.
all is lost. And so what's interesting to me is I don't see that as the big battle scene. The big battle scene, which is the core event in a war story, I see as when the German army actually comes rolling through, and as men try to escape, they radio in, they tell the leadership, hey, guess what? The thing we said was going to happen is happening. Then they try to escape. One Jeep is destroyed pretty quickly. The other one runs out of gas. So they have to, the expression of their gift is they use their smarts, their intelligence. They don't do the standard military thing. It's a slightly different take on that, but they disguise themselves as medics and they're able to,
instead of like going down shooting,
which is what the leadership I think would have them do. So eight, the protagonists are rewarded with at least one level of satisfaction for their sacrifice. This is hard because there's not much satisfaction to go around. You know, some of them survive, at least physically. Mother gets a commendation and he gets a transfer to the motor pool, which I suspect represents a safer duty station. And essentially they get some inner satisfaction of protecting mother, of following, you know, like the bond of the group being to protect him from that information.
Right. Well, and I was just, even when you were saying the core event as the, when they're escaping, and the fact that they use father's body, you know, escaping with, and that's, you know, it's very symbolic of the brotherhood. They get to use their fallen man, and he's part of what they use to help escape. So he, even in his death, he still gets to representatively help them escape. And the fact that they're able to protect mother in the end and get him to a safer place for his mental stability. And that was the dying wish of father. So again, little satisfaction to go around, as you said. The more and more we go through this, the more layers there are and the more that we could tweak. So I like hearing you on the spot go, oh, you know what? Actually, I would look somewhere else. And here's where I would look, which is great. Okay, so on to the conventions of a war story. Anne, why don't you tell us how that played out here?
There are, what do we have, four or five of them here, five conventions that we have officially listed. The first one is that one central character has offshoot characters that embody that central character's personality traits. And I thought, well, you know, if you squint, you can see that Will, our protagonist, Will Not, his fear of losing control, his desire to be a good leader, his dubious relationship with faith, you can see those reflected in other members of the squad. There's the religious man. I think you're pushing it to try really hard to find very specific, oh, this is that characteristic and that's that characteristic. But it is a nice little ensemble of very different young men with very different character traits. So that's there. You can find it. Another aspect of the war story that is called for is a big canvas, that either there's a wide scope external setting or a big internal landscape. The external landscape in this film is actually very almost claustrophobic in feeling. It was filmed in Park City, Utah, actually. I read this in the snow. And the snow, it's not this beautiful, bright, shining snow. It's kind of dark, cold, you know, with the trees closing in, the aspens closing in, and very beautiful, but very closed in. So the big canvas is internal. And really, the bigger canvas is just implied because we sense that we're towards the end of World War II. The story takes place right before or during preparation for the Battle of the Bulge. And that's the big canvas. And these guys are not on that canvas.
Right.
So I think it's there sort of in absentia. It's there as sort of a ghost, the missing center of the story. So the little tightly knit intelligence unit is a small canvas, and it's the war itself that's out there. That's the big canvas that's driving them to be making impossible and sometimes not very smart decisions. A third one is that there are overwhelming odds in a war story. The protagonists must be substantially outnumbered. It's interesting because this movie and this novel don't meet that convention directly. In fact, the little German unit that they've got is basically exactly the same number of men in exactly the same configuration, very young men led by one guy who's old. So they're not overwhelmed by the guys on the other side of the line there. The real antagonist is their own commanding officer and the system that he represents. And his dishonor and his incompetence, and who has absolute control over their actions and choices. They really don't have any choice but to go, even though they know it's stupid. So that is a great gap, as there always is, between a commanding officer and just the guys on the line. But also the overwhelming presence of this build-up to this massive battle that's going to move the war towards its conclusion. It's so big that we don't even see it, but it's the reason why the soldiers are sent off significantly on their own and left and abandoned when they when they need help the most. So that's a pretty big power gap there. There's a clear point of no return moment when the combatants accept the inevitability of death. We can argue about this because I'm not totally sure, but I feel that after they reached the agreement with the Germans to stage this fake skirmish and surrender and failed to tell Mother about it, and Mother opens fire on the Germans, and when he shoots and kills his own comrade, he shot Mundy, I think, by accident, right? Yeah. A little hard to tell with this bootleg of the movie that we watched. So the Germans naturally begin firing back because they think they've been tricked. And I think the real exact moment of the point of no return is when the other four of our American guys decide they have to return fire and kill all but one of the Germans. They've accepted that though they're supposedly an intelligence unit, they aren't safe from, you know, from being killed or from killing, particularly from killing. And that was the point of no return for them. The fifth one is this sacrifice for brotherhood moment. One protagonist sacrifices himself for the good of his fellow soldiers. And it's true that, you know, Mundy, the father, is shot trying to throw himself in front of Mother. I don't think that's the biggest sacrifice. I think it's Will who sacrifices the truth and his own honor by telling a, you know, a lie about the fiasco in order to protect Mother's mental health and his honor. So I think that was the sacrifice, the real sacrifice moment.
Excellent. I love how you said, how you were describing the big canvas, and you mentioned there's this big canvas and they're not on it. And that's why they stick together, right? They're not part of this other bigger purpose. They really don't understand what they're doing it all for. Which just was a very interesting phrase.
Yeah, there's an explicit moment in the script where Will says something about the pointlessness of what they've been sent to do. It's not that they can't see it. They can actually see exactly how pointless they are on this big canvas.
Excellent. Thank you. Leslie, you had pointed out some additional conventions. Can you walk us through those?
Sure. These are from alternative script writing, a book by Dan Seger and Rush. And this is, you know, it's for films, and the conventions aren't exactly the same. Sometimes they're just a little bit different, but in different ways to think about them. But I thought they were good food for thought in terms of war genre in general. So we have the object of desire is to survive, and that survival could represent personal survival, national survival, or the survival of values or honor. The next one is the character's values are tested, which is, check.
check.
There are polarities of human behavior, that is. There's barbarism and altruism coexisting in the same story, which is really interesting. Then we have violence playing a central role. That's pretty obvious. The relationships take on a particular importance, which I think part of that is the brotherhood, but part of that is just when people are in extremely stressful and traumatic situations, they tend to bond or not. And then there's a political perspective on the war, which is expressed over the course of the story. Sometimes it's critical, sometimes it suggests that the extreme conditions of war bring out the best and worst in people. There's a primal quality and intensity to personal behavior. And they didn't explain this specifically, but something that I was thinking about was that the things that these guys are doing, if they were doing them in a different context, you know, outside of war, at home, the worst that might happen to them is they spend a night in jail or something. But in the context of a war, things that aren't normally a big deal can get you killed. And that's just like that impact of that context is huge. And then another thing is that the antagonist might never appear on stage. we might never actually engage with them in that way. So yeah, those were just interesting, and I thought they add a little bit to our understanding of the genre.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you so much. Did someone have something else to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that it's interesting that, you know, behind all of this in World War II is Hitler. And mm-hmm. and they do bring Hitler on in the form of the one Jewish member of the squad building the snowman that is mm-hmm. representative of Hitler and writing, you know, the big antagonist in the whole underlying background story does kind of appear on the stage. I think it's interesting mm-hmm. that they brought that in.
Yes. I think there's that part where they mention even the German soldiers themselves don't really want to be associated, saying that they're not Nazis. And so just ways that they bring it in and remind us really that we are in World War II, right? And like what the enemy is. And so, yeah, those are interesting of how you make the antagonist force still appear on stage, even if they're not actually on stage. That's awesome. That's a great example. Okay, so, Anne, if you would carry on and tell us about the POV and the narrative device for this one.
Yeah, this one was really simple and straightforward. The book itself, which the movie adapted, I guess, very, very closely, is written in first person mm-hmm. memoir mm-hmm. style. And they use that device not only with keeping Will as the point of view character, but they also use an actual first person voiceover. It's a narrative device that is frowned on in more recent years, I think, but it's very effective here. They don't overuse it, but it allows them to set, it allows the story to be set up very clearly. You hear this young man's voice talking about what, here are the people in the group, here's what has happened before, here's how we lost six of our squad, and so on. So you get this very simple background, which also has the effect of letting you know that he survives.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
there's the dramatic irony, I guess you could call it that, where we know all along that this person survives, and it kind of heightens the tension of whether who else might or might not survive in the story.
Right.
But it's very, very simple, straightforward first person telling his story to, I think, kind of appease his conscience or unload post-war. Sort of a therapy type of first person, let me tell you what really happened.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay, so Valerie, if you would walk us through the objects of desire, aka the wants and needs.
Absolutely. We've already touched on the want, which is not wants to keep his troops safe, and they want to survive. In terms of a need, if we go back to the opening voiceover where Knott says that the reason they have the no profanity rule is that we want to make it clear we're not part of this army. What Knott and the squad needs is to understand that they are most definitely a part of the army. Mm-hmm. And as such, they're subject to all the, you know, to all the things that happen. They can't skirt around it. And it's the lesson that he learns right at the very end when he's sent back. It's part of the infantry.
Right. Okay. So needing understanding and needing to recognize the truth and yeah, that he can't keep himself separate.
That's right.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So carry on with the controlling idea and theme for us.
Okay, so before we started recording, just for you know, anyone listening, we spent quite a bit of time talking about this because I really struggled to get this into Sean's form. Yeah,
yeah.
For his framework, where is, you know, honor triumphs when X or honor mm-hmm. doesn't triumph when Y. So mm-hmm. a couple of podcasts ago, I talked about a series of articles that Steve Pressfield has on his blog, and I can't remember the dates offhand. I think it was February 2015 maybe, or maybe February 2016, and it goes on through May. And he talks about how the theme is expressed in a number of places in a story. The title, the hero, the cast of supporting characters, the villain, the inciting incident, the climax, the point of view, and the mood. So when I looked through all of those things, I kept coming up with issues around order, peace, chaos. I mean, it's a war movie, so we've got war and peace mm-hmm. there, and order and chaos. And, of course, we know the global value in a war brotherhood is honor and disgrace. So if we take all of these ideas of chaos and order, the way they show their honor is through this order. Like, so for example, Will, the name is so, is messing me up. Will not, his nickname becomes Won't. He won't be part of the war and the chaos it brings. Mother is nicknamed because he gives them grief about being sloppy and leaving things around. He wants order. Father has the no obscenity rule, and so on and so forth. The villain, who we've said is Major Griffin, is the angel of death, and in civilian life, he was the undertaker. So he sort of represents chaos or dishonor. And I'm seeing, you know, nothing in this movie is quite as black and white as we would like it when we're trying to do this analysis.
Right.
But, you know, the when we
I like my stories gray, except when I'm analyzing them, right?
Totally. Exactly. Totally. I mean, this one's got a lot in it. I mean...
Totally. So when we spoke through all of this, we came up with the controlling idea or theme of honor prevails when you're loyal to your brothers, even in the face of dishonorable leadership.
Right.
Just to reiterate, we had a hard time with this because it's there's a lot going on in this movie and in the book, especially because the movie follows the book pretty well. And You get layers upon layers, and you know, even all the supporting characters, as Valerie mentioned. I mean, there's just a lot going on, and you just have this deep. The character development here is actually really quite well and done quite well, and we'll talk more about that a little later. But it's a tough one, but I think Valerie nailed it because it is ultimately a brotherhood story, and how are you going to protect your brothers from the knuckleheads above you. I mean, it's basically what they're trying to do.
Right. Well, and it was interesting, Valerie, while you were talking us through the controlling idea and theme, I wondered if as we continued talking, if at least for myself, if I would get a clearer understanding of what the internal genre was. And one thing that you said kind of solidified it for me. You mentioned, you know, of course, with his nickname being Won't, right? And then all of these things like they're saying, we're not part of, you know, we won't be a part of this army. We're not, you know, we won't, you know, they're just thinking that they get to be separate and that they won't have to do the same things and that, you know, just all of those things. And then in the end, of course, they do have to, and they do take losses. They do have to kill other people. And so that really does feel like worldview maturation, because it's almost like his naivete, massive sophistication is thinking, I'm on to you, bad leadership. Like, I know, you know, like as if because he's disillusioned at the beginning, thinking that he gets to be separate, and then realizing that in war, nobody gets to be separate. So that's kind of maybe where that maturation comes. And then therefore, it like, but our ultimate theme is, like, you're right, nobody gets to be separate. So the only thing we have then is our brotherhood and our honor for one another. So anyway, just the way you had phrased that about his nickname being Won't and that he doesn't want to be a part of it. And then, of course, that he does have to be and the repercussions. So anyway, I agree with you. Worldview maturation is kind of is where I'm landing now.
Yay.
Yay.
Consensus.
No, we're just beaten down by this now.
Right? I like it. But we have our brotherhood, our round table brotherhood.
Yeah,
and we will stick together no matter what. Okay, back on track. Jari, please walk us through the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff.
Yes, we shall. So so beginning hook, I mean it's a pretty straightforward one, at least in my opinion, you know. Will Not, or Sergeant Not, gets the mission to go to the chateau. The complication is, as they're going up, they see something on the road. Mother shoots at it, and it's the German and American embracing, and they think, oh, what the heck's going on? This is crazy. So they sort of know they're not alone. And then throughout this whole, like, figuring out the chateau and whatnot, they see the soldiers, they do a little recon, and they actually now see the German soldiers, and their real crisis is, well, should we just kill them? It was either the night before when they were kind of, I mean, they're little kids, so they're like making fun and talking and making little noises, because they're basically watching a cemetery. So what they come to the conclusion of is that these guys could have killed us. They didn't, so let's not kill them. That sort of then kind of gets you to the inciting incident in the middle build where the Germans want to meet, and they want to figure out how to surrender with honor. The complication is, well, they're not going to tell Mother about this meeting. And they're trying to hide it from them because they really want to kind of keep him away from this because, again, he's kind of going crazy. Then they're trying to sort this all out, and really the crisis for them is, do we really trust the Germans that they're going to honor their word? And more importantly, do they, I think, internally, like, trust themselves? Like, can we pull this thing off? The climax, the meeting is, you know, tense. And as they're kind of going back and forth and meeting them, they kind of figure out, okay, these guys seem to be just like us. So as the middle build sort of resolves, you know, they start singing Christmas carols and they give gifts. I mean, they put, one of them puts the grenade on the Christmas tree. And I think it was, I don't remember who it was, but I'm like, oh, that's a great little ornament. So yeah, I mean, this, and what I should mention, which may not be clear, is during the middle build, it's not obvious that the Germans want to surrender, which kind of leads to the, in my, at least in my mind, you know, the ending payoff where really the inciting incident of that is like, now they really want to, hey, we want to surrender, you know, we want to fake this battle to save our honor, because if we don't, then our family's going to get messed up. So they then start doing the battle, and what happens? Mother shows up and starts shooting, shoots father, and this whole crisis is, okay, how the hell are we going to deal with this now? I mean, to them, it's like, oh man, like, you know, we had this, it's just this chaos scene. And when we talk a little bit more about the examples, I'll tell you why this particular scene is actually a pretty interesting and innovative way. So then what happens is Major Griffin, the antagonist or the embodiment of all that is bad in the army, he's like, hey, what's going on? What happened? And they're like, okay, what do we do? Well, they all keep quiet. They all get reprimanded. And then they sort of get left there. And they're like, hey, when the battle comes, let us know and then get out. And this is, again, a ridiculous thing. And so, you know, as they're going through this, they're like, oh, man, you know, we got to stay here. What, you know, this is like, this whole climax lasts a long time because this is a very dynamic time. And then finally, the resolution and then the ending is they masquerade as medics taking father's body with them and make it back to their unit, and mom's the word. They don't say anything. They have kept their brotherhood intact, and the consequences are the consequences, and the thing ends. So there is actually a lot going on. and you know, where these things begin and end or whatnot could be up for debate, but there's a lot of character development. You get to know these characters, you get to know some of the minor ones, which we don't talk about a lot. And he really did a great job of explaining, at least to me, I do see a lot of the hero's journey, the hero being Sergeant Knott. And then his personalities around. I mean, it's hard. It's kind of hard to find it, but I mean, they built these different characters kind of around him to kind of be what he would want to be. You know, there's the one person that should have been in charge, the one that got trench foot, who is actually the best soldier in the unit, and it just so happens that, you know, he wasn't around when they gave out the sergeant's stripe. So. Really, I mean, I wish we had a better copy of it because I think it would have been a you know, really wonderful thing to see on the stage or, you know, on a big screen. And again, this is a really, in my opinion, a really great example of a brotherhood story as well. I think it's even more powerful than Platoon, in my opinion, just because the development is a lot more. I mean, you're sort of past the hazing part. I mean, they still haze each other, but they're like a unit.
Right.
You know?
Right.
They've already like bonded.
Right. And it's like in a love story, right? We're past commitment, right? We're into intimacy now, right? Like, so they're already that connected, right? Yeah. Instead of just like the courtship brotherhood, right? Of getting together, right? Now they're already to that level.
Right. And then I think Anne mentioned it, that they do sort of have a sequence that's, I don't know, what's it called? Like what happened in the past when they go find, they're all virgins, and so they want to go before they ship off, right? They don't want to die virgins. So that's an interesting way he did that as well, because that's one, that's the bonding thing and kind of a ritual mm-hmm. that they go through, and two, it's just unexpected the way it happens and kind of what they how they go about it and kind of their feelings, and you know, they're legitimately, there's some tension and some nerves and they're scared. And at first you're like, why throw that in? And then realize, oh, that's the bonding scene. That's the, mm-hmm. we're now a unit scene. We're now brothers, because mm-hmm. they kind of have to go through that crucible, which is, I know sounds silly, but there's a mission they have to complete together to bond. And
that makes sense. Awesome. Well, thank you. Okay. So going over to good examples. So these are going to be special scene types or outstanding tropes or clear tie-ins to other genres, just something that you feel like this movie is a great, or this story is a great example of. So, Anne, will you start us off on this?
Yeah, I thought that, you know, I always like to watch a movie and see, I think about how, you know, I know I've seen this scene before, because mm-hmm. movies in particular are made up of pieces borrowed from other movies all the time. And so a lot of times the innovation in that scene is just how it's filmed or how, you know, how it's lit or something like that. In this case, I thought there were two that I know that I've seen that were wonderful. The biggest one is obviously, very obviously to me, where soldiers from opposing armies meet sort of in the mm-hmm. middle of the battlefield and recognize the humanity in each other. Mm-hmm. And it's a feature in a lot of anti-war stories, and there's a harrowing scene like it in All Quiet on the Western Front, which I haven't seen the movie, but I read the book. And it's not so much meeting as human beings, but in that case, one of them watching the other one die and recognizing in himself that this was a human being with a family and so forth. But that moment of yes. recognition that the enemy are just people is a mm-hmm. is a key to, I think, especially anti-war stories, which I could argue this is. Similarly, there's a scene where, and you've seen this in comedy, you've seen it in super dramatic war stories, brotherhood stories, where the soldiers who've been deprived, hungry, cold, hot, thirsty, whatever it is, they stumble on a cache of relative luxury and enjoy a respite from the war. And they mm-hmm. have that here. They go into the chateau, they find mattresses, they can light a fire. You also see that in All Quiet on the Western Front. And I know, I can't think of examples, but I know I've seen it a dozen mm-hmm. times in movies, particularly yes. about war.
Yes. Awesome. Great. Jari, you had one.
Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned before, I think the battle scene, the fake battle scene, is pretty innovative. If you needed a obligatory battle scene, coming up with a fake one where the pomp and circumstance and then marching out. I mean, it's like, uh-huh. I mean, you just sit there and you go, this is absurd beyond absurd. And like,
right.
you could have done this 1,000 different ways, but you chose to do it this way. And it's just this
well,
wonderful.
That's so funny, because when Valerie had mentioned in the theme, right, and how Stephen Pressfield talks about in the core event, you know, it's going to have, that's going to be part of the theme. And so the fact that in this one, the battle scene is a fake battle goes to the theme of the absurdity of the leadership. You know, like it really lends yeah. itself to the fact that this is a ridiculous situation.
Yeah. And yeah. I personally think that this is the obligatory battle scene, because mm-hmm. it shifts the whole story. I mean, it's the point of no return. It's the, they completely change their attitude about things. It's like, you know, they've seen their fellow comrades die before, you know, when the 12 became 6. But now this 6, the 6 that survived, you know, they're now bonded a lot stronger. And now reality, just like for them, this is a big, huge moment. And I think is the battle scene. And that's why it's mm-hmm. so innovative. It's like, it's the mm-hmm. battle scene, but it is fake. mm-hmm. And then it turns into a real, so that's the other thing. It goes from mm-hmm. fake to like, oh my God, it's real. Like legit, right. everyone's dying. You're like, oh man. And I think it is funny when you see the way they do all this and the blood that they use, and maybe it was just the video we saw. It looks so fake. The blood looks so fake. I mean, the budget must have been like ketchup or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's sort of, I think, pretty innovative in this particular case.
Awesome.
I was thinking that it's interesting that this story is set in World War II. It's a war that is, you know, that most people agree was an honorable war, as opposed to some where people disagree. And we usually see World War II and the events in war movies as being, you know, more positive, not necessarily pro-war, but hey, we're doing a good job there.
Right, pro-cause, you know? Right, in that case.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that there is, yeah, that we believe in the cause. And so it's unusual to see this, to focus on this aspect of, you know, incompetence in the leadership and ridiculous policies and that kind of thing. One other thing that I was thinking of when Jari was talking was that we can see the negotiations between the Germans and Nott and his team as that, again, battles and fights and things like that don't have to be literal, mm-hmm. that those negotiations represent seeing a proposal as a sort of attack or, mm-hmm. a sortie,
right,
or whatever. Right. Like, it's just another way to think about it, that it can be, everything doesn't have to be literal.
Right. We don't need bullets flying for there to be, they're advancing and you're going to have to react now, right?
Yeah, there's conflict there, right. Even though we have two groups of people who essentially want the same thing. Mm-hmm. We all want to survive. Let's work together. How can we make that happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about how even the fact that they have to stage the fake war so that, or the fake battle, it all kind of points to the theme, right? Like, in order for the German soldiers to maintain their honor, they have to stage this fake war, and the fact that they need the Americans' help, so like they have to bond in brotherhood against absurdity. Again, just another symbol of the same repeating theme.
Yeah, so, and I think it's a shame that it's not available in a better form, because mm-hmm. it is a good movie, and I recommend pushing through the difficulties of the mm-hmm. of the format to for
I wonder
the story.
Because we were looking for a streaming version. I wonder if you just on Netflix or something to get just the DVD, if that's available.
I think you can get the DVD through Amazon.
It's notoriously a Korean bootleg, however, so. Buyer
beware. Oh, right.
Yeah. Read the
buyer
reviews.
Beware. Yeah. Right.
Oh, even the one that you purchase as a DVD. Okay.
That's what the reviews say. Yeah.
Well, it's been great. Great discussion. So thank you, Anne, Jari, Leslie, and Valerie for our excellent editorial insights into The Midnight Clear. We hope that our discussion helps you and your clients write a better war story. Links to the Fool's Cap and other materials will be in the show notes. And we'd like to invite our listeners of the Story Grid editing community to comment, argue with our interpretations, and just generally keep the conversation going. So join us again next week when we'll be taking on the society genre with Thelma and Louise, which I'm really looking forward to. We would love it if you would just give it a look during the week so you can follow along with us. And thank you all so much. We will see you next week.